Thank you very much. For me, coming here is always really like homecoming. John Algio is responsible for this title, for this talk. He thought if he gives this title, which is actually the title of my last book, that that would mean I could do anything under it, being on my side. But then one of his colleagues told me just today that they're going to use this book, I think in the Olcott Institute Study Circle or some such name. I didn't quite catch the details of this, but it basically really collapsed any talk that I was going to give. If this book is going to be read by some people anyway, so why should I be repeating it now? So I don't know what I'm going to talk about. Largely because really what actually interests me is something I actually don't know much about. But I suggest to you that's your situation as well. And that's really, in fact, everybody's situation. You are probably like me, and you often pretend that you know what you're talking about. But seriously, deep down, what attracts me or you, or really serious human beings anywhere, we don't know very much about it. So let me just really begin with this, since I wasn't entirely sure where to begin even, that it is my impression that although the names and the labels have changed in the history of humanity, but that as if there is a great attractor situated in the very heart of the cosmos, as well as in the very heart of our own souls, that attracts us. I believe that there is something, and you don't have to accept this. In that sense, I don't use the word belief, you know, agree to this. There is no need to agree to anything. But look at this. And I am suggesting that there is something which we don't know what to label, so a great attractor is a nice quantum mechanical sort of label to it, that interests us, that attracts us, and really which gives in some way a meaning, a direction, a significance to our lives. Traditionally, people have called it love, or sometimes truth, or sometimes God, sometimes cosmological order, or some other varieties of names like this. But it is something that we don't really know very much about. Especially the kind of knowing that would be considered by somebody else as knowledge, in which we have data, we have truth tables, in which we can have everybody else agree to this, and on the basis of which we can make televisions or atomic bombs or something like that. That kind of knowledge is not what we have of this great attractor, or anybody has. Occasionally, in the history of humanity, we have had people who, in a way, speak to us. Their language evokes echoes from us. It speaks to our hearts. There are people who have some connection with this reality. And in a way, it could rightly even be said that they do know this. But if we listen to their words, they almost always say something to the effect that this is not the kind of knowledge that you could write down in books. This is not the kind of knowledge that could be just easily told to somebody else, and then you do ABC, and then you have this, right? So even those people who are, for us, exemplars, models, teachers, avatars, incarnations of God, even these people although something in us would more or less agree that they seem to know what they are talking about. But we do not assume even of them, partly on their own testimony, that what we are hearing is all there is to it. So we have this really rather a curious paradox, and I happen to just be situated in this afternoon with you here all listening to this more or less a private conversation, that what is really worth speaking about is unknown to us. And whatever we can in fact know or talk about isn't really particularly worthwhile. But we're not going to let this paradox paralyze us, because if we were, as some of you would immediately metaphorically grasp the meaning of this, if we were both, or all of us, climbing a little mountain or a high mountain, there is a conversation that can take place between people, especially between one person and another. It's not usually a matter of having an audience on the side, but it could also be in a group. A conversation that is a conversation on the slope, which is very different from a conversation that takes place by the campfire at the base camp, where people can describe the glorious ascents they have made or their forefathers have made, or what wonderful scenes they saw over there, right? So what I think, although is what is over there cannot really be described, what is it that attracts us cannot really be told. However, there is a meaning to these conversations in which there is largely a conversation among people who are on the slope together. Then in between their climb, perhaps they rest for a few moments, look around, and maybe wipe the sweat off their brow, perhaps, and have a few minutes chat. But the important thing is not the chat. The important thing is the fact that they rested in a process. In a process, in this case, I'm using obviously only the metaphor of climbing a mountain. So, in some languages, these words or this attractor actually literally, maybe some of you know, in fact, I think last time I was here, I probably said that, that's literally what Krishna means. Krishna means that which attracts you. So I do have, I suppose I will relate this to the topic given for this afternoon. Teaching of Krishna is really something to be discovered, not as something given forever, but is for those who are in the process of climbing a mountain, who are pilgrims of the spirit, or are on the path, then they cannot help themselves but be drawn by something. That something is Krishna. Now, what does this say to you? Or what teaching it has for you? Or first of all, how does it even talk to you? How do you hear something that is not easily hearable? Maybe some of you know this story in one of the Upanishads. Those of you who may not know what the Upanishads are, this is a whole genre of literature in India considered very sacred. And there are many of these Upanishads. Traditional number is 108, although we seem to know many more of them than 108, but the number is, traditional number is 108. In one of these Upanishads, more specifically Chandogya Upanishad, there is a story of a young man. I suppose it somewhat reminds me of myself 30-odd years ago, who was rather full of himself and considered himself very intelligent and smart and could do everything. So his father said, it's time that you are, after all, born in a family of Brahmins, and in our family we are not Brahmins merely by name or by birth, but we are Brahmins in truth, which literally means that we search for or relate with Brahma, which again literally means in Sanskrit the vastness. So a Brahmin is one. Obviously, I speak here not with regard to the castes as they now sociologically play out. I'm speaking as the ideal. A Brahmin is one who is related with the vastness. So his father recommends to him, this young man's name is Shvetketu, which just sounds nice in Sanskrit, so I mentioned this. It doesn't matter what the name is. You can substitute your own name for it. He goes to learn with a very learned teacher and spends 12 years learning and returns even more full of himself than before. And he says to his father that now I know grammar, I know astronomy, I know the latest physics, if you like, we can modernize this in our own jargon. So his father says to him, well, this is quite wonderful. Now, do you know how to hear what cannot be heard? How to see what cannot be seen? To which, of course, as you would anticipate, Shvetketu Aruneya, this is his full name, Shvetketu Aruneya, says, well, such a teaching I have not encountered. But that is precisely the teaching that this great attractor, or Krishna, or please feel free to substitute your own label for this. What the whole teaching is about is, how do we hear behind the labels, behind the words? So it will be a real tragedy, from my point of view, if I just provided you another one or two or three labels to provide further obstructions in your own search. On the other hand, human language is condemned to use labels, subject, object, predicate. So I'm using the word Krishna here merely for that purpose. In the literature gathered from various countries and by various researchers, one remark which is often made by people who, it appears, return from the other side, is that they either meet a being of light, sometimes they identify this being with the Buddha or with Jesus Christ, depending on their emotional language with which they have grown up, which is perfectly understandable. However, the one common feature of the instruction given by this being of light, sometimes they don't even personify this being of light, they just have this message coming to them. Not coming from somebody, but just the message is coming. And that those words or the ideas are that what is really important in life are love and knowledge. Sometimes they substitute the word wisdom for knowledge, but these are the two words which occur quite remarkably uniformly in the description gathered by lots of doctors, lots of places, dealing with near-death experiences. And of course, from any traditional point of view, whether one is thinking in terms of Plato, or whether you think in terms of Advaita, or any of the Indian philosophical systems, or Christianity, or Judaism, really any of the traditional systems of thought, one would notice that there is always a great deal of emphasis placed on both truth and love in these systems, everywhere. However, the emphasis that I am here more trying to place is not, of course, truth and love, but I am also trying to say that this also is again very, very traditional, that these things are not just attributes of reality, but that these are reality. It's not that there is some being or the universe which feels love. That is a way of saying, perhaps. No, that love is what constitutes the universe. Truth is what constitutes the universe. And that, now I return to this talk I gave in this under the title of Healing the Soul. At least in my judgment, and here I can simply really more simply give you a two-sentence conclusion of this rather than repeating the whole talk here. I believe that within each individual and within any culture, the moment these two are separated from each other, there is already then the entry of the seeds of not only fragmentation, but seeds of violence, seeds of partiality. Now, how would it relate to our situation here? Our systems of knowledge and science for most of us is really, in a way, the system par excellence for searching for truth. Even though I finished saying earlier, now I don't need to repeat this, that science is not the only knowledge or the only way of knowledge. However, it is a grand, great system. There is hardly any question about this. But it seems entirely irrelevant to its entire domain, whether a scientist is a complete son of a bitch or is a loving type, right? It's wholly irrelevant. In fact, the greatest scientist probably in the history of humanity, Newton, was a perfectly terrible man from what we can gather. Vindictive, small-minded, small-hearted, maybe large-minded, but small-hearted. Vengeful. You'll be really unhappy if your daughter wanted to marry him. But clearly the greatest scientist that we have known. So there is no requirement of this. There is a separation of this. And it is with this in mind that I would like to draw your attention to two or three related things. One is actually our century, in particular now since we are very much at the end of the century, it is already possible to reflect upon this more or less as the fin de siècle kind of analysis of the century. There are two, I believe, very important ideas or phrases which are relevant to understanding our century. One is the idea of system. Everywhere there is discussion of system theory, treating something as system, discussing this, whether it's organizations or whether it's molecules or whether it's the galaxies or stars, everywhere, systems. And this is really, in fact, a rather a grand achievement of contemporary science. How much can be systematized? How much can be understood as system? And how many of these principles of system theory can be applied across the board to varieties of systems? The other idea is in its essence almost completely antithetical to the idea of systems, but very important in the 20th century, and USA will be a very good example of this, is the idea of presence. All the teachers who have made any waves in this century in the USA or anywhere else, for example, Krishnamurti, for example, any of the Zen teachers or the Tibetan Buddhist teachers or Guruji, for anybody you can think of, all of these people have one thing in common: always an emphasis on being present. Varieties of phrases get used: being mindful, being attentive, being here and now. Other ways of expressing this. Even in the meditation this morning, for example, some of these words were naturally used. Not to worry about the past or the future, but to be here and now. Systems and presence are completely opposed to each other, but they don't have to be. In general, they are, I should say. Or the way they get emphasized. Systems, although they are intimately related with the search for truth, and of which I have already given science as one great example of this, it is, after all, what drives all the great scientists throughout their history, have driven them. They are searching for truth, not just really even with a capital T, although they have been badgered down by many of the contemporary philosophers against using the word with a capital T, truth. But nevertheless, that is really what drives them. Systems have, on the other hand, naturally a tendency towards generalization, but also towards abstraction, away from the person. The system does not make room for the person with his or her completely unique characteristics and foibles and follies. Love, purpose. System abstracts all this. Earlier I quoted Blake. I should tell you that this was actually Blake's main objection to the whole of 18th century science, which for him was personified by Newton and Bacon and Locke. And he regarded these three to be members of a satanic trinity. In fact, one of his poems has exactly this phrase in it, and he actually refers to the satanic mills of Albion, etc., which ends, that poem ends by the remark, reasonings like vast serpents enfold around my limbs, bruising my minute articulations. You see, the abstract system, reasonings like vast serpents, as if they crush the individual body and they drown out the minute articulations. And no doubt some of you are probably scholars of Blake here, so I don't need to go on in detail about this, just to remind you that for Blake, it's the minute particulars that is the specific glory of all human relationships. I know as a generality, it was even remarked by Professor Elwood today that many of the theosophists don't seem to have a special generosity towards Christian theologians. However, this is really one of the very important points that Christian theologians have always insisted, and in my judgment, quite rightly, although it can also become narrowed down, but that ultimate reality, God, is a person. That doesn't mean a person who has a beard or has a comb in his pocket or a handkerchief, but that it has the minimum qualities of a person, which is to say purpose, intention, will, which is very much related with the idea that I earlier mentioned. Unless it is a person, at least in that minimal sense, it cannot love. If ultimate reality has love as a part and parcel of its built-in structure, then no abstraction of a philosophical principle or a theological idea will do, which is why you get this remark like Pascal saying, not the God of the theologians or of the philosophers, but God of Moses, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You see, there is always this sense of a person-to-person encounter, which is very much a very strong driving force of the biblical traditions. However, I'm not here about to defend those traditions. I'm merely making the point that this idea that the ultimate reality, when it loses contact with these personal qualities, with these minute particulars, then it is heading towards a disaster. It is heading towards a system that can become very abstract. Systems have a tendency in their abstraction to isolate the human beings from each other. Presence, on the other hand, is relational. It has always to do with one-on-one. It's not a machine answering your phone call. It is a person-to-person call. It's a very different feeling when you actually get an alive person on the other side. However, the whole domain of persons, or the whole talk really of presence or love, this also naturally has its pitfalls. It can lead to a kind of exclusivism that we shall love only within our own community and none other. Or it can lead to a kind of sentimentalism, which is why this reminder from Dante, we are not talking about just ordinary love here. We're talking about a very cosmological quality of love, which is itself a cosmic force. Associated with these two are many other things. For example, for the intellectuals generally, it is much easier to think in terms of systems and abstractions and generalizations. And it is in this field that we see the whole area of consciousness studies, levels of consciousness. It's interesting that every teaching, any spiritual teaching, even when they are emphasizing search for truth, which they don't all do equally, but in fact almost all of them do in some form or the other, usually the more insight or wisdom-oriented traditions, especially in the Orient, tend to more emphasize this. But it is emphasized really everywhere. In these traditions, the actual preparation of, or the actual spiritual practice, always lays a great deal of emphasis on what traditionally is called moral preparation for the person. Now, the word moral has acquired a bit of a bad press, just because it's not very hip. So what is behind any place where there is an emphasis on moral preparation, what is behind this really is always finding room for the energy, or not only just finding room for it, but actually transforming the energy that is almost always getting lost in negative emotions. All moral preparation is really to do with this. It just sounds a little easier on our ears these days to talk about preserving or transforming the energy of negative emotions. But that's exactly what classically was meant by moral preparation. However, whatever words would appeal to you here, more importantly, the point to be made is this, that this kind of preparation was always considered as necessary before one can come to a higher level of consciousness. Or if I can just slightly substitute another word, a higher level of conscience, was considered as a prerequisite for a higher level of consciousness. And it is a useful thing to remind ourselves that English is really rather peculiar in separating consciousness and conscience from each other. Anybody who speaks French here in the room or Spanish would immediately see that these two words cannot be separated. Let me also remind you, the same is true in Sanskrit. Same is true in many, many, in fact, practically all ancient languages and many modern languages, which is already an indication to us that this emphasis on levels of consciousness without ever referring to the moral preparation, but that, as I said, is a word that doesn't smell right these days. So one may say levels of conscience, or without referring to the whole energies of the heart, which is otherwise being dissipated negatively. It all arises from the same general tendency which wishes to now systematize levels of consciousness, to put it into a system. Whereas all matters to do with conscience are obliged or arise from a one-to-one encounter with the other. I see my time is going. Can I take a few more minutes? I'm just warming up a little. You see, conscience and consciousness, or truth and love, or system and presence, there, in a way, we separate them, and therefore our difficulties arise. But I wish to keep just reminding you, at least I'm hoping to keep insisting on this, that I'm not speaking about a human being having conscience and consciousness, or having truth and love. No, I am actually speaking about that everything that exists has both of these, that the whole cosmos has both of these. And then we see that the separation is really a partiality. And if we then look at the actual experiences of the sages, then we will see that even though it is also true that there is a kind of a lineage of sages in any culture, and in any given lineage, a certain language is accepted because that's what the great master said at some stage, and that language is then repeated. So we get cultural divides even in the expressions that the sages use. However, if we try to be people of goodwill, but more importantly, if we try to have this conversation with other people also on the slope, not Buddhism or Buddhists talking to Christians, I think that whole talk is, I know at least there is one very highly respected professor of comparative religion here, and I'm glad and emboldened in saying this in his presence. I believe that this kind of talk is just making these traditions remain more and more in watertight permanent compartments, which is really passé. This is not the requirement of the age. This is not what will be required in the next century. What we need is an inter-pilgrim talk, not an interfaith talk. But tragedy is, my own books often get, you know, with great appreciation, somebody says, it's a good book, an interfaith dialogue. And what the hell can I do? So I'm stuck with it. I'm not interested in interfaith dialogue. Because that means you establish the faiths. And then a person is an ambassador of that faith and is hell-bent to defend that, even if it's wrong. There is no need to have interfaith dialogues. What we really need are, in my judgment, inter-pilgrim dialogues. But that is going to take some time yet. But next generation, I hope. However, if we have an inter-pilgrim talk with people or sages really from various traditions, then one thing which one notices that it is possible to hear behind the words, like Shvet Ketu Aranya. This is itself a kind of an education, how to hear what is not ordinarily hearable. All training in meditation is really to do with this. We see, let me take a specific example, and then we see the danger that can come from it. Even though it may arise in a very religious context, even in the very highest context, there is a remark of Krishna. Well, first of all, maybe I'll tell you this in English, then maybe in Sanskrit, just so you hear the sound of it. Krishna says, this is in the seventh chapter, that at the end of many births, a wise person submits himself to me. And such a person realizes that all there is Krishna. And he says, to be sure, such a person is quite rare to find. So we don't need to imagine that everybody has this experience. But now, in Sanskrit, it says, bahunam janmanam ante. Jnanavan mam prapadyate vasudeva sarvam iti samahatma sudurlava. I already gave you the translation, so I don't need to translate this. But the idea that all there is Krishna. This is such a central idea in Indian thought. It takes many, many forms, that there is an underlying unity of everything. All is one. Even the devil is myself. Certainly God, that's easier to accept. All the gods and devils are within us. This is a remark of the Buddha, for example. Or Nagarjuna even takes one step further. Sansara and Nirvana are the same. You name it. In the Indian tradition, for at least 4,000 years of recorded talk about this, the sages in one form or the other have repeated this. In fact, from the point of view of the spiritual teaching or training in India, your level of development is practically judged by the degree to which you understand this statement. Not understand simply in words, even I understand. But to understand this in such depth that all your action automatically follows from this. That you actually live recognizing that everything is divine. Even the person you think is your enemy is also divine. So that's the realization I'm speaking about. And that to the degree that one actually realizes this, not simply reads this, or gives lectures on it, as I'm now doing. But to the degree one realizes that that indicates the degree of development of a person's soul. Now, you see, this idea is so grand and comes from the very highest source, is Krishna himself saying this in the Bhagavad Gita. And that it's a little difficult to take exception to this and still be considered a good guy. But in my personal judgment, something like this has actually played quite a havoc in Indian tradition. Because this has been made as a part of a system, forgetting that even Krishna, even God Almighty himself, could not replace a single child. That there is not only the oneness of everything that exists, there is also the uniqueness of each being. And that the experience of the sages in fact speak about their own lives, in fact incorporate both of these. It is true that in some cultural contexts, and more so in India, the oneness of everything is emphasized. In some other contexts, for example, in the biblical traditions, uniqueness of everything gets more emphasized. But as I said, if we were to speak as one theologian talking to another theologian, or one person of faith talking to another person of faith, then it's a whole drama which is going to have its pitfalls. But if one pilgrim speaks to another on the mountain slope, one can read behind these words, one can hear behind these words. And you actually see the life histories of these sages who use phrases like this. And even though it may do some violence to our logic, what is very interesting is that in their own lives, they actually simultaneously hold this idea of oneness of all there is and also the uniqueness of everything that exists. Linguistically, maybe it doesn't make sense. Logically, it doesn't make sense. There are many things in quantum mechanics doesn't make sense, as Ralph would agree. But in quantum mechanics, if we are physicists, we are just used to the hubris of saying, well, if this doesn't fit in with your logic, well, too bad for your logic. Then, of course, we create more different kind of logic, as we have now in quantum mechanics, multi-valued logic, etc., etc. But it's the same thing in the other experiences. Our logic, particularly the logic of the Aristotelian logic of the excluded middle, cannot possibly contain all these experiences. And therefore, too bad for logic if it doesn't contain this. However, the actual experiences of the sages have this wonderful quality of relating both of the, or holding both of these, if you like, in tension at the same time. But what happens then? We get many echoes of this very system, or this very system is really the right word here, or this idea when it is systematized in the tradition. For example, the same idea occurs in the Chandogya Upanishad, in the remark that verily he who knows clay knows all forms of clay, therefore does not need to know any single parts. It may be all right for the sage who said this, but I'm married to a potter. And let me assure you, it is absolutely absurd, and I think it has done a lot of damage in the Indian aesthetic sense to claim that one pot is just like any other pot. This arises merely from the notion when a great idea, which in experience is always held together in a tension of oneness and uniqueness, when that is systematized, we talk about the unity of everything there is, and therefore once you know clay, you know all clay. Well, hell, you don't know all clay. I can assure you, if you had an exquisitely carved Chinese vase, well, I don't know about the Buddha, but most people would be very unhappy if it broke in their hands. And also, now I haven't known the Buddha, but I've known some really quite great wise people. Krishnamurti among them. In this audience I mentioned this, but there are others. They have an acute aesthetic sense, which always requires an attention to the unique vase. It's not just all clay. This is like, sometimes you go to, especially in the third world, you know, you can buy little jewelry just by the weight. It doesn't matter what the design is, what the form is, but it's just the weight of silver. Everything is melted down, so it doesn't matter what it is. You see the kind of thing I mean? And in my judgment, actually, this particular idea was particularly popularized by Shankara in the 8th century. A wonderful, great man of great feeling, actually wrote more love poetry than wrote on the Vedanta. Most people don't realize this. However, his followers take this as a system, and it has had, in my judgment anyway, really quite a pernicious influence on the Indian sense of aesthetics, particularly in its contact with religiosity, with spirituality. Therefore, most of the Hindu ashrams or temples, especially since the 8th century onwards, lack what one would ordinarily call aesthetic. Absolutely marvelous temples, especially in South India. Some of you have seen these. And then you see a totally terrible tube light in front of everything. Has anybody here suffered this? Or you go, the worst museum in the world, I think, is the so-called, I don't think it's called National Museum. It's some kind of, well, it's a big government museum in Madras. Maybe it is called the National Museum in Madras. I have personally the impression that the bronzes they have there in one single room could be probably good collateral for the entire Arabian oil fields. They have such enormous value to them. But the display of this is so atrocious. You see, this is the kind of thing I mean when a thing is systematized. You forget the whole uniqueness of this. Therefore, this whole notion that reasonings like vast serpents enfold around my limb, because what this is doing is taking away one side of real constituent of reality. I should probably really ultimately should stop here, but it may be just useful to remind again, since I have been quoting from the Bhagavad Gita, that this is actually not so in the actual disciplines or with the real sages. We need therefore constantly to be guarding against the idea of systematizing something and then forgetting because now we have a theory of it as if now we understand this. So if I can actually return to my previous, maybe I won't quote from the Bhagavad Gita, but quote from Meister Eckhart here, I feel in good company in saying that I don't really know what I'm talking about, because one remark he made that if I had a God of whom I could form any idea, it would not be worthwhile to have him as God.